Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Almost 1 year after Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico's infrastructure, Puerto Rican students are heading back to school. In April, the Puerto Rican government announced the shutdown of hundreds of public schools across the island because of what they said were economic concerns and a drop in enrollment. But there's one school that will open on Monday for the first time. The Puerto Rico chapter of the Boys and Girls Club will begin operating the island's first charter school. The Vimenti School in San Juan will open its doors to 58 students, kindergarten through fifth grade. There are nearly 7,000 charter schools on the U.S. mainland. So how is it that Puerto Rico is just now getting its very first one? Well, in March, Governor Ricardo Rosselló signed a controversial law paving the way for charter schools to operate. Here's Governor Rosselló on our show back in February talking about his plans for education reform.
We're adding charter schools to Puerto Rico so that we can, you know, attack a lot of those schools that haven't done so well and give those children the opportunity to progress.
But the move has faced fierce pushback from academics and the teachers' union, who see the move towards privatization as a dangerous one. When they lost their fight in court, they took it to the streets. Kayla Lopez Alicea is a reporter for Nuevo Día in San Juan, and she's been covering education on the island for nearly a decade. Kayla, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
So let's talk a little bit about what the mounting problems were with the schools on the island before Hurricane Maria, because we knew that there was already a bit of a fragile infrastructure there, right?
Yes. Well, you know, we had low-performing schools. Students weren't really reaching their goals. We had bad infrastructure. A lot of our schools are very old, and they didn't get the maintenance they needed. Plus, there were also issues with teachers, the contracts. So it was a bad panorama before the hurricane hit us.
And so even before Hurricane Maria, Governor Rosselló had been talking about bringing charter schools to the island. What was the reaction then?
The reaction was mixed. This is something that has been talked about for a long time. Charter schools, we've been hearing about them for years. So people weren't really sure what that meant. There was a lot of pushback from the teachers' organizations and the teachers' union because they fear that this will create a hostile environment or weaken the education system. But he ran on a platform that included charter schools and voucher programs, and the people voted for him. So when they started talking about a school reform, it was maybe 50-50, people against it and people for it. Basically because the schools are so low performing that most of the people believe that something just had to be done.
So I want to talk a little bit about the broader issues here on the island. I mean, we're seeing a lot of this issue of disaster capitalism, right? Where, and we've seen this in Puerto Rico with the criminal justice system, the power grid, you know, basically companies coming in and taking advantage of privatizing what were once public assets. And it seems like the public school system could be the next public good, if you will, to be a part of this. Is that what you're seeing?
That is one of the fears that the teachers' organizations are stating, that this could open the door for companies that have no scruples to come in and damage the public school system.
And we ended up reaching out to the Secretary of Education for Puerto Rico, Julia Kelleher, and asked her, you know, how she would respond to those who are concerned about the privatization of the island school. So we're going to play you a clip from her.
This is the first time that Puerto Rico has had the degree of visibility it has into how the department's budget is allocated and utilized. I think that through transparency, sharing our data and information, clarifying how we made our decisions, we'll be able to alleviate any of those fears and have people fully understand, you know, how we made the decisions that we made.
Your reaction to her comments, Kayla?
Well, that is one of the arguments the government is using right now a lot. Through the education reform they passed last March, they have created new databases and new systems of information that would supposedly give out more information, show the public how the public school system actually works, because right now we're not very clear where the money goes. So if the school system, the Department of Education, excuse me, can prove that the money is being properly used through charter schools, it would alleviate a lot of the critics' fears about how these schools are going to be working.
And, I mean, you've been covering education for a very long time on the island. Is this just the beginning, this first school, just the beginning of more charter schools to come from your experience?
Yes, it is. The law actually states that there will be like a cap. Only 10% of the Puerto Rican schools can become charters. So right now that would be a maximum of around 80 schools. But, you know, laws can be amended. There are more proposals on the pipeline the Department of Education is evaluating, and they will probably open the process up maybe in September, October for new entities to come and, you know, try to convince the government that they can run a charter school. So we can expect a lot more of these kinds of school centers to open throughout Puerto Rico.
And charter schools, obviously, even here in New York, get mixed reviews. Some people are 100% for them. Other people feel that they set up their own systems of inequality in certain communities. What's been the reaction from parents that you've been talking to so far?
There was a bit of a backlash throughout the last couple of days. The announcement for the first charter school was made on Sunday. And for the last 4 days, there has been a lot of backlash against Boys and Girls Club. People believe they sold out. But also, there's a lot of hope. And like I said, the school system is failing. People are worried about their kids' education, particularly people in high poverty areas, which is the zone where this charter school will be operating. They will be operating out of a public housing project. So there's a lot of hope in part of the population that this is something that can help turn around our public school system.
And going just beyond this charter school, we've mentioned that the government of Puerto Rico has closed hundreds of schools across the island. And we spoke to a mother in Dorado, Puerto Rico. Her name is Vanessa Santana Gonzalez, who says that her kid's elementary school wasn't on the official list of closures, but in late July, they got word that it wasn't going to open. And the Department of Education actually assigned her kids to a different school far away from where they live.
Every day you hear them say, I want to go to my school. And you tell them, you can't go to that school because it's closed. You have to go to this school. What they are doing is an imposition. It is what it is. If you don't like it, go somewhere else.
Your reaction to that, Kayla?
Yeah, that has been the biggest issue this school year. Throughout the summer, the Department of Education closed over 200 schools. The number kept changing throughout the last couple of months, but I believe that at the end, the schools that were closed were 256, which is huge, taking into consideration that only 854 maybe stayed open. We had over 1,000 schools last year, and there's been a lot of confusion because of all the school closures. Right now, classes started last Monday, yet a lot of teachers were not assigned to any schools. So there's been a lot of confusion this school year about where the students should go, where the teachers should go, how the schools are going to operate. Parents have been saying that schools are overcrowded. Teachers keep saying that the facilities aren't good enough. So the Department of Education has been, you know, asking people to have patience, that this is part of a bigger plan to transform the school system because there are not enough resources and the student population has been dwindling for the past couple of days.
Can you give us a sense of what that student population looks like? Because I feel like we hear a lot about people have left the island, but now school is starting up. Are people returning? What's the population look like for kids in schools right now?
Well, since last August, according to the data from the Department of Education, over 40,000 students have left the public school system, which is a lot of kids. Over 22,000 students left after Hurricane Maria, probably during the months of November and December. They have been saying that maybe 6,000 students, 8,000 students returned during the summer. But that's still a low number compared to the amount of kids that left.
And let's also talk about Betsy DeVos. She visited the island recently. Tell us a little bit about her visit and what it portends for the Puerto Rican education system.
Well, the press had little access to the federal secretary when she came. They did visit a couple of schools. She has been supporting the school reform project that Governor Rosselló and Secretary Kelleher have been pursuing as soon as the law was passed. I remember that she tweeted a message of congratulations, because what we're doing right now is Puerto Rico is following the federal guidelines, you know, the federal agenda to increase the number of charter schools, to increase the school choice options that parents have, to increase voucher programs. So basically, they're following Trump administration guidelines when it comes to education.
Kayla Lopez Alicea covers education for El Nuevo Día in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Thanks for joining us, Kayla.
Thank you for having me.
The Queen of Soul has passed away. Aretha Franklin died today at the age of 76.
I want to be free to fly away and sing.
It's impossible to overstate the impact that Franklin had on American music. All you have to do is listen to her voice to understand why she was such a legend.
Chain, chain, chain. Chain, chain, chain. Chain, chain, chain.
In recent years, Franklin didn't tour much, but still pulled off some unforgettable performances. She performed My Country, Tis of Thee at President Obama's 2009 inauguration, and in 2015, she played You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman at the Kennedy Center Honors.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired.
Here to discuss Franklin's life and legacy is Daphne Brooks, a professor of African American Studies at Yale University. Professor Brooks, we really appreciate you being here with us.
I wish that we weren't having this conversation, but thank you.
Well, we are, unfortunately, and I guess we could probably start with, you know, when you think about Aretha Franklin, does anything come up for you specifically? Is there some song or memory or feeling that you're dealing with right now?
Oh, God, it's all feeling. She was a master of feeling. She was the one who was able to convey the inner life worlds of Black folks and a new level of complexity that the pop world had never seen or heard. My favorite and most beloved performance of hers that I hold so dear to my heart is her extraordinary, exquisite cover of Bridge Over Troubled Water. But it's all feeling. I mean, she was, you know, a virtuoso who was able to use her, you know, her vocal gifts to convey and compress a whole range of feelings that the modern world really demanded and needed. She was the site for this kind of cathartic reckoning with ourselves at, you know, the height of the civil rights and Black power movements, the dawn of the feminist movements. I could go on and on. She's a national treasure.
You mentioned feminist movement and the civil rights movement, and I can't think of those two things without thinking about, I think the song we're all thinking about is Respect, which really, I feel like, became an anthem for both civil rights and women's rights in many ways. A little bit about how Aretha was involved in that civil rights movement in the 1960s.
Well, of course, she was the daughter of the great C.L. Franklin in Detroit. So she was a PK, a preacher's kid, who really developed her chops in the church, as all of our, you know, great African-American musicians of the 20th century you know, have that legacy as well. And C.L. Franklin, of course, was deeply tied and connected to King's movement. So she grew up in a household, you know, that had these social political luminaries, but also gospel and pop luminaries who were drawn to Reverend Franklin. You know, everyone from her idol, Dinah Washington, to, you know, local grassroots activists. She was extraordinary in that sense, in the ways that she was able to kind of absorb, you know, all of that social and political energy, all of that kind of aspirational vision, and turn it into sound.
And also, you know, talking about the song Respect, when that song was actually written by Otis Redding.
It was, yes.
But Aretha did a little bit of, she put her own touch on it. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, long before American Idol, she was, you know, the artist who made the song her own. So, and Otis Redding, you know, may he rest, was incredibly generous in saying this woman has taken this song and turned it into, you know, her own anthem, her own will to power. So, you know, we now understand it to be her signature song, but originally it was Otis's.
There's, of course, another song that comes to mind. It's a cover song of Carole King's You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. What do you think made her version of that song so distinctive?
Oh my goodness. You know, if Black feminism has a soundtrack, it's bound up in that song, which is also, you know, a beautiful testimony to the cross-racial, you know, interracial coalition building of soul music itself. We understand soul music to be, you know, expressive of African-American vernacular culture in there. There were some wonderful allies who were involved in the production of that music, like Carole King. But, I it was really a moment in which we were able to hear a kind of deep embodied maturity of Black womanhood. But Natural Woman was, you know, just a masterpiece in terms of allowing us to really, you know, be called upon to reckon with the preciousness of Black women's humanity. All of that is bound up in that song.
Daphne Brooks, a professor of African American studies at Yale. Professor Brooks, thank you, and I think we're going to end this segment with some classic Aretha.
Thank you. When you're feeling real low, here's a great truth you should remember and know, that you're gifted and black. You got your soul intact. Oh, and that's a fact.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Out this week, Crazy Rich Asians is making waves as the first major studio release in 25 years to feature an entirely Asian cast. Based on the best-selling book series by Kevin Kwan, the movie tells the story of Rachel, a Chinese-American professor who goes with her boyfriend Nick to meet his family at a wedding in Singapore.
It really brings you into, you know, this world of old money versus new money, social caste, social hierarchies in Singapore, and it feels really fresh.
Film critic Rafer Guzman reviewed it for us on Wednesday's show, but the creators behind the film had to work hard to convince Hollywood to make this movie. Adele Lim is one of the screenwriters of Crazy Rich Asians, and she told me that in her experience writing for television, it's always a struggle to write Asian characters into a show.
Particularly when you're trying to cast strong Asian male characters, anybody who's, you know, a little bit more assertive, more, you know, sexually commanding, you get, you know, sort of like a lukewarm response from your showrunners, you know, who in their experience had not seen Asian men that way. And you would get more pushback from casting, who would, you know, their first go-to would be, can you retry for a Latino or an African-American actor instead, as if, you know, one minority is completely interchangeable with the other.
I spoke with Adele and her co-screenwriter Pete Carelli about how they brought Crazy Rich Asians to the screen, which began with pushing for a non-white female lead.
Our main protagonist is Rachel Chu, and she is an Asian American professor, and she's our eyes into this world. And I think the argument in the beginning of, you know, a white female protagonist was like it's an outsider that most of America could relate to, but that's, you know, supposing that an Asian American isn't, you know, that American point of view that you need. And I think more importantly, the Asian American experience is so different from the Asian Asia experience. And, you know, hopefully in this movie, people get to see a little bit of that. It's, you know, the narrative of growing up as an other and feeling that otherness even when you go to a country of people who look exactly like you.
And that's such a uniquely American, you know, hyphenated American experience often, isn't it?
Yes. And I think also Rachel's coming in with a very American perspective of like, I can do this. Like, this is going to go great. Like,
right.
this isn't even going to be a problem. I got this. That, you know, confident American thing only to get rejected by the organism that is Singapore rapidly. You just aren't going to do that with a white lady. It's just not going to work.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you touched on it, that hyphenated experience. And it's what a lot of my friends here have experienced, like Korean Americans, Japanese Americans going back there. And after that first sort of flush of, oh my God, I look around and everyone's like me, you know, even if they didn't very much feel like an other over here, going over there in that first, you know, flush of experience, feeling like you're really one of the people. And then you open your mouth, you know, and you ask for non-dairy creamer. And then,
we don't have soy milk. No. Yeah.
I'm laughing. I'm laughing because I've had similar experiences. Yes.
But the fun thing to note is, I think, you know, on set, because Michelle Yeoh is, you know, we shot a lot in Malaysia. Michelle Yeoh is Malaysian Chinese. She grew up there and most of her career played out in Asia, whereas Constance Wu, you know, grew up as an Asian American. So in that way, they're very much like their characters. And so when Constance went there, it was, you know, first time in Southeast Asia, you know, she really brought a lot of that, you know, to her performance and to her character, in that it was really plunging into the deep end of, like, you know, the Asia pool for her.
Peter, you were the first person to work on adapting the book. What was that process like for you initially? And did you have any sense of the world that Kevin Kwan set the book in? Were you familiar with that?
I was a little familiar with it, but I absolutely had a lot of educating of myself to do. I knew from the book, I very much had the experience that I think Rachel had of being a stranger in a strange place. When I took the job, the first thing I said is like, look, I got to go to Singapore for a couple weeks. Like, mm-hmm. I gotta learn this place. And I've got to really, you know, meet some of these crazy rich Asians over there and talk to people about the experience and how Singapore has changed over the last 50 years, the politics behind it, the people, how it affected, you know, why does everybody speak English? Why does everybody have an English accent? Where do people really live? So just listening to people was kind of how I educated myself as I was learning as I was going along.
Adele, tell us a little bit about your process in this when John Chu, who's the director of the film, brought you on board. I mean, you grew up in Malaysia, which borders Singapore. So tell us a little bit about your experience in working on this.
Yeah, I'd worked with John. We'd sold a TV pilot to Fox, which didn't go, and he reached out to me about this. And I can't tell you how excited I was. You know, I grew up in Malaysia. I came over to the States when I was 18, and I've worked in TV for 16 years. But you know, I've never had a chance to really write for an Asian lead character. And this book and this experience was the first time I, you know, didn't have to tell my experience and put it through a prism, you know, to make it fit a different character. I could just reach in and just pull it out. Like, the dialects, the food, you know, the old generation Anglophiles, like, it was all, like, they were all people in my family. They were people I knew. The dynamics of the aunties, that hold that your family has on you, like, they own you, like, everything just, you know, it, I didn't have to reach for it. It was just sort of all there. I was ecstatic.
And this is your first feature film credit, but as you mentioned, you've done lots of other TV work. Did you, when you were writing in TV, did you have a chance to write many Asian characters?
You know, in most of our cast, I think there was only one show where we had one Asian character on our main cast. And so, you know, what you try to do is, you know, have not just Asian guest stars, but, you know, try to diversify it that way. It shouldn't be on the minority writers to do that, but frequently it is. So, you know, it was always, I sort of took it for granted. It wasn't, you know, a grudge. It wasn't, I just assumed like that was what the machine was. And so when this came along and it was in the right time, the right space, Kevin Kwan's book had foamed the runway for us and really had, you know, done all the work in terms of, you know, making sure that there was a market and an audience and enthusiasm for it. You know, it was a completely different situation.
So one thing we know that Asian American viewers, and I think many viewers, are really excited about with this movie is the range of roles that Asian actors get to play here. I'm wondering what it felt like for both of you to create Asian characters who aren't just, you know, extras, or as you mentioned, Adele, just sort of, you know, the one-off character of color.
It's funny. I was listening to Jimmy O. Yang, who was on Marin, and it's something I've encountered too in a lot of Asian guest roles in TV shows, which is when you are represented, you know, so rarely, you carry the burden of the entire race and culture on your shoulders. So that if you are playing a villain or you're playing, you know, sort of like a, you know, an offbeat, quirky character, suddenly, you know, you're taking on the burden of, oh, you know, are all Asians villains? Are all Asians, you know, like crazy and zany and they're purely for comic effect? And in Crazy Rich Asians, when you have a cast, you know, where the entire cast is Asian and you're completely represented in that 360 way, you don't have to have that extra layer of, you know, this cultural responsibility that you're holding on to. You can just write from a place of joy. And that was just a really freeing experience, I think, for writing, for directing, for acting. And, but, you know, a little bit on that, even though, again, it's all Asians and we can, you know, you can take liberties you normally might not be able to, it was still important to just emotionally ground our characters. And yeah. I think the one where it's most apparent is with the character of Eleanor, which is Nick's mother, you know, like the future mother-in-law. And there's this trope with, you know, Asian mother-in-laws and mother-in-laws in general, you know, and how they can be like petty. And, you know, Michelle Yeoh was really clear in the beginning about not wanting to play a villain. And having grown up in that culture and, you know, growing up in a family of very strong-minded aunts who, you know, feel free to tell you how to live your life, you know that it comes from a place of love. And so it was important with her character and in this heightened world that she was grounded emotionally, that all these things that she was doing, you could understand it, you knew where it was coming from. It's this fierce devotion she has to her son and to her family. And so we really wanted to make sure that, you know, that was highlighted and that she wasn't just this cartoonish villain.
Where do you both want to see Hollywood go from here in terms of Asian representation?
For me, hopefully this movie is proof of concept. Hollywood will chase money. they will. If something's successful, there'll be 10 more behind it trying to do the same thing. And there are so many stories to be told. And we don't for a second think that this is the end all and be all. Hopefully this is the amuse-bouche of Asian representation films. This is just the start.
Yeah, I think, you know, history is a sobering lesson. The first contemporary all-Asian cast movie, the last one was Joy Luck Club, which was 25 years ago. And I think on the heels of that, there was this expectation that the face of entertainment would change for those actors, for movies and TV shows coming out, but it really didn't. And having worked in TV for a while, I think it's a lot to do with content creators. I've never felt, you know, it was overt racism in terms of exclusion of a particular group of people, but, you know, writers write what they know. And if you grow up not seeing or being friends with a certain kind of people, you're not going to write for them. So I think, you know, on the heels of Crazy Rich Asians, hopefully, which, you know, will have traction and, you know, fire up the imagination of, you know, all Americans, that it will pave the way for more diverse, you know, entertainment in terms of movies, in terms of TV shows. I just want to add this last bit. I was on a notes call for a TV pilot I'm working on, and the development executive mentioned to me that, you know, in every development cycle, there are, you know, there are jags that they go on. And this year, you know, there was this big emphasis on, you know, having family dramas like Crazy Rich Asians or projects with Asian leads or Asian families or diverse families. And a lot of it's, you know, dependent on how this movie does. So I think that speaks a little bit to, you know, the import of this movie in terms of representation for minorities moving forward.
No pressure, right, Adele?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, Pete, I mean, wow. Okay. Well, you know what? I have to say, so far, the reactions have been superb, and I think there are lots of people looking forward to seeing this. Adele Lim and Pete Corelli are screenwriters of Crazy Rich Asians. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Immigration is one of the biggest stories of the past year, or any year, really. And while our focus is largely on Latin American migrants who are facing the brunt of this administration's punitive policies, they aren't the only population getting caught up in the immigration detention system. So far in 2018, nearly 4,200 migrants arrested by the U.S. Border Patrol have been Indian nationals. That's compared to a little more than 3,100 in all of 2017. And it's something that Sarah Parvini reported on for the Los Angeles Times. And Deepak Aluwalia works with this population as an immigration attorney in both Texas and California. Sarah and Deepak, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Tenzing.
So, Sarah, you recently reported on the number of Indian detainees held in three of these California facilities. How many people are we talking about? And why don't we hear more about this population?
So we're talking, depending on which facility in Southern California, anywhere from 20% of detainees being from India, or as many as about 55%, if you're looking at the Victorville prison where detainees have also been held. And so I think part of the reason that we haven't heard about this specific population a lot is just because, understandably, as you had mentioned, we have been focusing on Latin American communities that have really, really been struggling under this administration. We have the family separation issue. And so I think that, you know, other things just kind of fall under the radar.
And are we seeing an increase in the number of Indian migrants coming to the United States?
That's what I've heard from immigration attorneys anecdotally. And then when I have spoken with immigration officials as well, they said that this isn't something that is, you know, new within the last 6 months, but this has been an uptick over the last few years, actually.
And Deepak, you're an immigration attorney. What have your Indian clients been telling you about why they're leaving their country? Is there something that's prompting them to flee specifically?
Yes, Tanzina. So it's mainly been political persecution based on membership or their affiliation with a particular political party there. And a lot of my clients have been telling me that they do fear persecution from the current ruling party, which is the BJP, the National Governing Party in India. What I'm also seeing, which has been a current trend, is a slew of migrants coming in who are claiming persecution based on being members of the LGBT community, or simply fleeing the country because of fear of persecution based on their religion. I have Christian migrants coming in from South Asia, specifically India as well, who are claiming fear based on their religion.
And Sarah, in your piece, you talk about, tell the story of an Indian migrant from the northern state of Punjab. Can you tell us a little bit about what led him to the United States?
Sure. So when I spoke with him, and this was through an interpreter, He mentioned that on multiple occasions he had been attacked by people who claimed to be members of the government party, the ruling government party. And it's my understanding that, you know, after being attacked two times, they threatened him and said, you know, if you don't switch over, if you don't change your beliefs, the next time that we see you, we will kill you. And so his family, you know, being afraid that, you know, they might actually do this, decided to sell part of their farm and sell some of the gold that they had and find a way to get him to Mexico and then eventually get him to the United States.
And Deepak, I'm wondering if you could help us understand, why are these migrants being held in federal prisons?
Well, yes, Tanzina, that's actually a perfectly good question that leaves a lot of people scratching their heads. The agreement really comes between Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and BOP, Bureau of Prisons, which falls under the Department of Justice. They've actually long had an agreement, Tanzina, where they house immigration detainees at these private prison facilities. The reason we're seeing this more so now is because it's happening in larger numbers, and more so you're seeing that because of, you know, instances like what happened in Victorville or in Oregon, where there's been a number of different legal and human rights violations from, you know, anywhere from not providing them adequate access to food, cutting off access to legal counsel and not letting them meet with their attorneys, pretty much shutting them off from the outside world is what's really brought this to the spotlight.
And are those the kinds of abuses and other, what are some of the other challenges or conditions for migrants being held in these prisons?
Well, Tanzina, to start with, you know, these prison facilities are quite far removed from the general public, right? If we talk about Victorville, that's about 85 miles away from Los Angeles. It's quite a distance from a lot of immigration practitioners. The other challenge is, you know, prior to the lawsuits that were filed by ACLU and other organizations, we weren't able to even speak to our clients. Our clients were telling us that they weren't able to make phone calls out to their families or their attorneys. They were being told, for example, certain Hindus who were not or are not allowed to eat meat or beef as per their religious belief were told that that's all they have and that's what they're going to have to eat. A number of other detainees let us know that they were put in their clothes that they were arrested in for several weeks before they're given a change of clothes. So that's just a number of issues that or challenges that they've been dealing with just recently prior to this lawsuit being filed.
And I'm wondering if you could tell us between 2012 and 2017, about 42% of asylum cases from India were rejected. Do we have any sense of why and whether that trend will continue with this current population, Deepak?
Yes, Tanzina. So, I mean, in short, you know, the quotas that were implemented on the immigration judges by the Department of Justice, also a lot of people not being granted bond or release by ICE or the immigration court is what's leading to these number of denials. And in my opinion, I only see it growing with the current administration.
Sara Parvini is a Metro reporter for the LA Times, and Deepak Ahluwalia is an immigration attorney. And I appreciate you both taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Open a newspaper today and you might notice a special editorial about the importance of a free press. The Boston Globe started this initiative, and today, Thursday, August 16th, more than 300 papers around the country are standing in solidarity against sustained and dangerous attacks against journalists in the United States. In response to these editorials, President Trump tweeted this morning, calling the press the opposition party. President Trump, the press is not the opposition party. It is our job to report facts, ask difficult questions, and hold the powerful, including the office of the President of the United States, accountable, and to tell stories that enrich our understanding of the world and of society. If we get it wrong, we correct it. But as an institution, the free press is vital, and it's a cornerstone of our democracy. And as a journalist myself, I'm deeply concerned for the future of the free press and the safety of those of us in the profession. I encourage our listeners to read one of these editorials and to pick up your local newspaper if you can, or turn on your local public radio station to support the tireless work they do. Thanks so much for listening this week. I'm headed to a public radio conference in Austin, Texas, and then I'm off for a week. Amy Walter is in tomorrow as usual, and Matt Katz from WNYC and NJ Public Radio is in next week. And I hope you give him as much love and smart thinking as you've been giving me lately. I'll see you in September. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.